Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Batman Nightcast, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Ryan Daly.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
And just in case this is your first time listening to Batman Nightcast, and I can't imagine why it would be, but I don't know your life. On this podcast, we review the comic book adventures of the Dark Knight detective and sometimes his partner, Robin, the Boy Wonder. The stories we cover can come from really any era of Batman publishing history and the many titles starring the Caped Crusader. As often as possible, we at the Fire and Water Network adhere to the maxim, find your joy. That means we want to talk about Batman comics we really like. You'll almost never hear us talk about bad Batman comics.
Anymore.
And this episode is no exception.
So coming up, we've got the first chapter of a macabre Bronze Age tale, well regarded by fans in our community. It's the first part of the trilogy that introduces the villainous Black Mask to Batman's rogues gallery. And later we start the second half of the 12-issue Batman and Robin Year One series with a review of issue number 7.
Before we get to that, though, we need to give a big shout-out to our Patreon sponsor for this episode, J. David Weider. A lot of you guys love listening to this show, but Dave's the only one who puts his money where his mouth is. If you want to assuage your crippling guilt by supporting Batman Nightcast, or, I suppose, any other show on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/fwpodcasts. Alrighty, Chris, what's going on? There's been a lot of Batman stuff going on since we last talked about it.
Yeah, it's been quite Batman heavy. Yeah, unfortunately, you know, just to get the sad things out of the way, we lost one of the great comic writers of all time, Jerry Conway.
Yeah, and obviously he was very close to the network. Obviously, being the creator of Firestorm and Shag was very close to him. They've interviewed him a couple of times. He also wrote Rob's all-time favorite comic book. And yeah, even though I reluctantly admit that I kind of often overlook him, but truly one of the greatest Batman writers, like in terms of run. And I can swear to that because after he passed, I decided to go and reread. Some of them were first reads, but I read his entire Batman arc and Detective Comics, his whole run from start to finish, binged all of those over the course of like 2 weeks, and really, really good stuff. I mean, it helps that it's 90% of the artwork is by Don Newton or Gene Colan, but a really, really fun arc. And he had some interesting touches with the characters and the saga of Rupert Thorne coming back after the whole Hugo Strange thing and this election, the Hamilton Hill stuff. And there was a ton of great stuff in that arc. And he was really, really special. And
that was that era where I was buying Batman and Detective every month by that point. I had pretty much started buying them, getting them when like Len Wein was writing Batman. But at that point I was old enough to really like you'd be actively looking for them in the next issue and to be get involved in the subplots and the ongoing storylines, which he definitely, you know, he was one of the, you know, first writers to really do that. And he was writing both Batman and Detective, which it, mm-hmm. so it became basically a bi-weekly comic in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And it was exciting times. I mean, you know, with the introduction of Killer Croc and Jason Todd, and of course that kind of wrapped things up. But he did the whole vampire storyline with the modern day version of the Monk, which scared the crap out of me as a kid. And at that time I didn't want to buy that. I skipped those issues cause I was such a wiener. But I went back and found them later. But, yeah, it was fantastic stuff. Yeah. He was, I mean, of course everybody thinks about, you know, his Spider-Man run. Cause he killed Gwen Stacy and the Green Goblin. And he wrote the first guy to really write Spider-Man regularly after Stan Lee. And he co-created Firestorm and a great number of other characters as well. But yeah,
the Punisher, kind of
a big deal. The Punisher, right now we're awash in a lot of Punisher in the media. He's exactly. And of course on the DC side, Power Girl as well.
Yeah,
and brought back the JSA and. Into their own title, but yeah, his Batman run probably does get a little overlooked, I think, but it's just because he wrote so many, he had such a great run on just about everybody, you know, mm-hmm. And he was just a powerhouse when it come to, especially the Bronze Age, you know, from start to finish in the Bronze Age, he was one of the big writing superstars. And I will always, I know we brought this up, but, he wrote, as you mentioned, Justice League of America number 200, and on Fire and Water, back before it was a network, when it was just a show, now known as the Aquaman and Firestorm show. Episode 100, Rob and Shag, with the help of some people like you and me, covered that comic, but they had Jerry read the opening that he wrote. Mm-hmm. And I still get chills when I listen to that. It's so awesome. Network highlight for sure.
And not just comics. I mean, he wrote TV and he wrote cartoons. He wrote a Christmas episode of G.I. Joe, the cartoon from the 1980s. He and his wife, it was an episode plotted by Roy Thomas and scripted by Jerry Conway, if you can imagine.
And they wrote Conan the Destroyer, right? They wrote one of the Conan movies, and he wrote the Appointment in Crime Alley that's for Batman the Animated Series. It's the adaptation of There's No Hope in Crime Alley by Denny O'Neill. So yeah, he was, and I think he worked on Law and Order for years, and so yeah, he was quite prolific. Yeah.
Shout out to Roy Thomas, who created Snake Eyes and Cobra Commander and Storm Shadow and all the other G.I. Joes too.
But not Cobra Law. He doesn't take credit for that.
And Conan, he created Conan, I'm pretty sure, he thinks. Yeah, again, it sucks. Like, we've lost so many creators that, you know, we love, like, in the last couple of years. Like, it's just one of those things where it's going to happen every year, a couple times a year. We're going to see, oh, damn it, I really liked that guy's art or that guy's writing or something. We're going to be missing these guys. But he was one, I think we all kind of knew, all right, it's going to be coming at some point, and it's going to suck because he touched on so many books that are beloved, not just by this network, but by the whole community, kind of, as you mentioned. But yeah, you also kind of mentioned his arc on Batman and Detective kind of culminated in that nice saga that introduced both Jason Todd and Killer Croc. And if things go the way I'm hoping they go, listeners, we're actually going to cover those issues at the top of 2027. So
yay, look forward to that.
Getting into Batman, we got other media stuff about Batman, including some casting news for The Batman Part 2. And we also got a teaser for the Clayface movie. Which do you want to talk about first?
We can talk about the Clayface teaser because that looks pretty freaking cool. I gotta say, I was expecting basically not a whole lot out of... I mean, I know who's involved. I thought it'd be good. But I just, you know, I mean... I never asked for a Clayface movie, but now that I've seen this trailer, I desperately want to watch this movie. So
I'm the same way, and I mean, traditionally I've been kind of against villain-centric projects. Like, I had no interest to see the Joker. I still haven't seen the Joker, the Joaquin Phoenix one. And like, I thought the idea of getting Penguin a TV series, I'm like, really, what are we doing? And then I watched the Penguin series. I'm like, that's really good. That's a really good show. And you know, the Suicide Squad movie that James Gunn did was good. I enjoyed that. And from the trailers of it, I was like, okay, this, I don't know if this is counts as a Batman movie, but as a body horror movie, it looks really interesting. And I like the character enough. So certainly for this year, and one of the things in coming back to DC Comics in the last year or so when we restarted this podcast, like, I'm trying to have this idea of no sacred cows. Don't hold on to these visions and these impressions of what these characters have to be based on my favorite versions or my preferred versions, because there might be something else that's completely different but is still really good, and I don't want to deny that just because it's different. And I there's no stronger testament to that than like the Absolute comics that are out right now. I'm sure we made fun of those a ton when we first heard them like announcing those, and then I started reading some of them. I'm like, these are good. It's not any kind of Batman that I've seen before, but who's to say these aren't better? I don't know. Just because we've had one Batman for 80 years, so what? Give us something completely different. Maybe it's Batman in name only, but I'm not going to let that stop me from enjoying it.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't know about you, but just the amount of time I've spent away from the ongoing DC universe as it, you know, the tumultuous DC universe of the past almost 20 years at this point, you know, it makes it easier to accept other versions, because it's like the version, and I know not necessarily the version that I kind of have in my head is my version isn't the same as your version where you came in a little bit later necessarily, but you know, it makes it easier, at least for me, and I think some people, to be able to be a little more open-minded about, okay, well, yeah, this, and I mean, this looks like they, and we talked about this before, that we thought this might be the direction they're going in. This looks like they basically took the two-parter from Batman the Animated Series and used that as the template to base this Clayface off of, and that's a hell of a good place to start.
Yeah.
Because you could remove Batman from those episodes, and it'd be a hell of a compelling story without Batman in it. So,
right.
Makes sense.
In terms of the sequel to The Batman, we got a few more casting things first. Like Matt Reeves came out and confirmed a lot of things first. Sebastian Stan is playing Harvey Dent, and Scarlett Johansson is playing his wife, Gilda. And the only reason you hire Scarlett Johansson to be Gilda Dent is if you're going to do something interesting with her. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody can kind of imagine what that might be. But they've also hired Charles Dance to play Harvey's father, Christopher Dent, which is interesting, which I'll admit is a character I've never heard of before. I don't know if that goes back to like the Geoff Johns Earth One Batman books or something, because Harvey Dent or something was in those, but I only read the first one. But I mean, Charles Dance, I mean, he's awesome. If you watched Game of Thrones, you know how great he is, but he's certainly been in lots of things. He's great at playing an old bastard, so you know what kind of character he's going to be in this one.
Yeah, I mean, he was in Del Toro's Frankenstein. He was Victor Frankenstein's father.
Yeah.
And he always, like you said, always plays just this, you know, authority bastard figure, you know. So, this all sounds great. These are all actors I like. I like Sebastian Stan, of course. I like Scarlett Johansson. I'll pretty much, if they're in it, then I know, well, it's at least that part's good, because they're just actors they're good actors. They're actors I like. I enjoy their work. Of course, a large chunk of that is because of the time I spent with them in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is interesting, which makes me wonder if, you know, we know ScarJo punched out in Endgame. It makes me wonder if Bucky's going to survive Avengers Doomsday and Secret Wars. But the only thing about it is, do we really need to do Two-Face again? You know, I'd like to see some other Batman villains get a shot. You know, now, of course, the Riddler they did in The Batman was 1,000 times removed from Jim Carrey or Frank Gorshin.
Right.
But with Two-Face, I think there's nothing you need to change about Two-Face. It's just such a, you know, he was like a very tragic and interesting and kind of an adult character, even in the Golden Age, you know, so he fits this world.
Well,
so
I've got a few thoughts on that. If they're using the Long Halloween as some kind of inspiration for this or template, which I think most people would assume they are, just because of you have Harvey and Gilda Dent. That's the only time she's ever really been relevant. If they use that as a template, I mean, Harvey does not become Two-Face until the very end of that story. And a lot of it is just his partnership with Batman and Gordon, and the starting to fray the lines of that friendship as they start to suspect maybe he is kind of losing it and killing these bad guys because he can't arrest them or can't put them in jail. So maybe if that's part of the story, and then like the idea that she's the killer at the end, and maybe he doesn't turn into Two-Face until the very last act of the movie, or maybe he doesn't turn into Two-Face in this movie. We don't know. But one other outside kind of, again, into like thinking about the absolute DC universe, before The Dark Knight came out, right after Batman Begins came out, I thought the Rachel Dawes character was pretty much a female Harvey Dent. It's like they created Harvey Dent, but a one that could be a love interest for Batman. And I thought, wouldn't it be crazy if she became Two-Face?
Oh.
If you just had a female Two-Face, like she's the one who gets scarred. And then you have the villain with her same motif and like, you know, you could call a woman could be Two-Face because they, then you also have the romance angle and the way that would have heightened their relationship, that Batman has this villain who's not just a tragic loss for him as a friend, but like as a lover or as a childhood friend. And I thought a female Two-Face would have been interesting in that. And I'm just kind of wondering, I mean, ScarJo's a pretty big star. I mean, we assume if she's Gilda Dent, she's probably going to be a killer or some version of Holiday in this. What if she ends up becoming Two-Face? And Harvey Dent, Sebastian Stan is kind of like a red herring.
Hmm. I like that a lot. And I mean, to take ScarJo, one of the most beautiful women on the planet, and then have her be Two-Face.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty bold. Of course, then you'll have the Legion of fans clutching their pearls and bitching about, you gender swap my character, or you race swap my character, or, you know.
Batman went woke.
Yeah. Batman went woke. but you know, which if it pisses those people off, that's fine by me. You know, so
just saying.
It's like the people that are having a conniption. I watched a video the other night about the new Masters of the Universe toys, and one of the guys he did a previous video about a trailer for the movie, and people were griping about Idris Elba playing Man at Arms, and he's like, he just flat told him, it's like, if you have a problem with this, then you're just racist. I'm like, good for you. So,
of all things that couldn't matter less, it's the race, the ethnicity of Man at Arms.
Man at Arms, exactly, in the He-Man, where there's blue, you know, I mean, where literally people are like, there's blue-skinned people, and, you know, it's like, yeah. Who the hell cares what skin, I mean, I don't know who cares anyway, but it's like, even less with He-Man, you know, it's like, it's just, I don't know. But anyway, didn't mean to get on that, but yeah, no, that's a great, I like that. If they did something like that, that would be interesting. And I really do hope they hurry up with this, though, because I saw the other day last week, Robert Pattinson turned 40. So he's now older than Michael Keaton was when he first started playing Batman.
Jeez.
Yeah, Michael Keaton was 38 when Batman 89 came out.
Wow.
So, think about that for a minute.
Yeah. Wow. And God, yeah, they were filming the first one during COVID, during the pandemic.
Right,
so it's been a minute.
It's been a minute. He was kind of a younger Batman then.
Well, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if they don't make a third one. This one might be it, considering how long it took them to get to this point.
Yeah.
And James Gunn is going to bring Batman into his proper DC universe, and they're not going to want to compete with a different Batman. As much as I think people would go to see two different Batman movies in a year, I don't think that's ever been a problem. But I just don't think Warner Brothers would want to do that. So
yeah.
I have a feeling this is the last Matt Reeves Batman movie in this world.
Probably so. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, unless they film them back to back and we just don't know about it or something. But I don't think they're doing that.
True. That's true. Anything else before we get into the comics?
Oh, well, you know, just watching, you know, Todd McFarlane just release endless amounts of Batman figures as he tries to maximize what he's got, the time he's got left with the DC licenses. It's kind of interesting because it's just been one bad variant after another, and a lot of other good figures getting solicited and stuff too, though, that I'm excited about. But, you know, and then we wait to see what Mattel is going to do with the collector line, the playline stuff, which honestly looks pretty collector friendly too. It looks good. So, you know, that bodes well for the future. So,
and none of the Batman that he's releasing are based on Neil Adams or Marshall Rogers or Jim Aparo, the ones that I would want.
No, he's not gone back to those. Although there are rumors that there is supposed to be a Neil Adams Batman coming, but who knows if that's true or not. So we'll see.
Anyway.
Okay. So our first comic is Batman number 386. It has an August 1985 cover date. And according to Mike's Amazing World, was on sale on May 16th, 1985. So, you know, right around 41 years ago, which that makes me feel old as crap by saying that out loud. Because I bought the sucker off the stands.
I don't think I even knew what a comic book was at that time.
You were barely crawling by then, probably. Yeah.
I still have my hands full of G.I. Joe and Transformers toys, though. I mean, okay. I wasn't.
That's good. Yeah, you did have. Yeah, it's true. The cover by Tom Mandrake has the mask and hat of Black Mask, who, of course, debuts in this issue, in the upper left corner, with Batman's cowl and cape in the lower right. Behind them, a red surprint, thank you, Rob Kelly, on a yellow background are images of other masks, including a couple of Universal Monsters. A ragged text blurb reads, "Crazier than the Joker, deadlier than Ra's al Ghul, introducing a villain for the 80s, Black Mask." So what do you think of this one, Ryan?
It's a striking cover. It jumps out. I think the color is doing a lot of that heavy lifting, but also just the composition of these two faces, disembodied kind of faces in the front. I don't know if I think this is a good cover, though. I like the idea. I like all of the images behind, but I don't know that I necessarily get that they are masks and not just disembodied faces or heads of some kind. Like, the empty cowl kind of says, okay, it's just a mask, it's not like the head, but it's also just a little bit weird looking, and you don't know who Black Mask is, so this face doesn't mean anything to us, and also he's wearing a hat, so it's not just the mask. I recognize this cover. It's something that jumps out at you, but the more I think about it, I'm kind of like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying. It is very striking. I think it does just the, like you said, the color treatment kind of pulls you in. It makes it pop off the newsstand. Yeah, and I do like that the word Batman is knocked out, so you can see the background of the serpent.
Yeah, that mask. negative space. That's good. I like that.
Yeah, I like that too. And I do, again, the creature from the Black Lagoon is off to the off to the left of Black Mask, and the Wolfman is hiding behind the UPC in the blurb. So I really like that. Yeah, that's a I'm sure there's other Easter eggs hidden in there too, but yeah, it's a striking cover for sure.
What did a villain for the 80s mean in 1985?
He's hungry like a wolf. I don't know. I mean, he's bad. No, I think I was a couple of years. That's a year or two too early. But he's an MTV villain. That's the thing that pops to my head, you know, but he's really not. But we'll get into that. This is definitely, this does feel like kind of a different type of story than what we were used to getting on the newsstands in a Batman comic. So
indeed.
Yeah. So the story is Black Mask Losing Face. It's written by Doug Minch. I believe that's how you pronounce the man's name. It's always mangled by us podcasters, but I do believe it's Doug Minch. With art by Tom Mandrake, letters by John Costanza, and colors by Adrian Roy. It was edited by Len Wein. Roman Sionis, heir to the Janus Cosmetics fortune, was born in typical fashion until his masked doctor dropped him. This may be why some people said there was always something strange about Roman, particularly his eyes. His parents rubbed elbows with the other rich and elite of Gotham City, including Thomas and Martha Wayne and their son Bruce. But Roman was a withdrawn, solitary child, obsessed with the mask he and his parents were forced to wear as they maneuvered through life. On vacation one year, his family took young Roman to a secluded woodland summer home. Roman was forced to put on a mask of excitement not only for the trip, but for a screening of an animated film about a raccoon during a visit to the local cinema. Later in the woods, Roman approached a real raccoon and was bitten by the rabid, masked animal. Delirious and lost in the woods, Roman was eventually found, but his parents noticed his behavior became even stranger after this incident. On his 21st birthday, Roman joined Janus Cosmetics and was shoved up the corporate ladder, becoming vice president. He met a model named Cersei he became obsessed with, much to his parents' ire. They forbid him from dating her, and Roman put on a mask of subjection. Then his parents died in a mysterious fire shortly thereafter, while familiar dead eyes watched behind a mask of leaves and bushes. Roman took over Janus Cosmetics and cleared out office space for a lavish apartment for he and Cersei and a room to display his mask collection, gathered from across the globe. He put all of his company's resources behind a new line of face paint cosmetics, using Cersei as the face of the campaign despite warnings from his underlings. The line flopped completely. Roman charged his people with conceiving an entirely new innovation in traditional makeup in exchange for a $100,000 bonus. A makeup designer stepped forward with water-insoluble makeup, and Roman gave it the green light, despite the employee saying it needed testing due to the aggressive bonding agent used. He fired the man, but kept his promise about the bonus. Roman Sionis lost face again when the new makeup caused irreparable skin damage to its users, and the company was slapped with over 400 lawsuits. And then Cersei left him, walking out in front of all of his disgruntled employees. The company only remained afloat thanks to a bailout from the Wayne Foundation due to the friendship that once existed between Bruce Wayne and Roman's deceased fathers. Roman, no longer in control of his own company, signed his name to the contract and then damned it all at the family mausoleum. Unable to despise himself, he shifted the blame to his father. Seeking vengeance, he unlocked the crypt doors, which were struck by a bolt of lightning. Blown backwards, Roman fell again, just like the first time he was born. He entered the now open crypt and used a large rock to smash the ebony casket of his father. When a portion of the lid broke away, he saw his father's burned, shriveled death mask below, and looking at the chunk of the dark coffin wood in his hand, Roman began to giggle. Roman Sionis disappeared, his mask collection gone from his corporate apartment. The makeup bonding agent was also missing from the company vaults. The police were baffled. But at the Sionis family crypt, the reborn Roman emerged as Black Mask, wearing the face carved from his father's coffin, a pinstriped orange suit and a fedora, and brandishing a gun, he recruited members to his false face society. A month later, Batman, remember him, apprehends one of Black Mask's society members, while the man himself and two of his other goons visit the bedroom of Janus Cosmetics' new chairman. When the Dark Knight, Commissioner Gordon, and Detective Harvey Bullock arrive at the man's home, they find him wearing a pig mask. When it's removed, it reveals the dead face of a withered monster created by the very compound Sionis stole from his company. Black Mask watches this from afar and tells the society that Batman will be dealt with, but first, Bruce Wayne. So, thoughts, Ryan?
For a little while, I thought I was reading an issue of Secret Origins starring Black Mask.
It's true. Very true.
I'm glad you mentioned Batman shows up at the very end, because as I was reading it, I'm like, 18 pages in, and I feel like we're missing something.
You get the back of Bruce, young Bruce Wayne's head in one panel before that. That's it. Yeah.
It's a good story. Obviously, it's very fun. This is I can't help but think about like the things that might have influenced Doug Munch or Munch, while he was writing this, particularly possibly The Omen with the little boy with just the dead eyes, kind of creepy looking. Also, maybe Thomas Harris's Red Dragon, which was adapted into the movie Manhunter earlier, looking at a serial killer this way, or somebody who becomes kind of like who's certainly kind of getting into the mind of a killer who can kind of function in other society. It's a fascinating kind of character study of this guy who will become a villain. And there's certainly enough meat here for somebody who could be a very prominent and powerful rogue in the Batman's gallery.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember at the time thinking, man, this is dark. because Mitch was clearly, he was going for something beyond the typical Batman story at the time. I mean, there seems to be a whiff in the air of the coming darkening of comics with Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen, I think. And actually in the newsstand comic, I pulled my old comic out. The Watchmen is hinted at Dick Giordano's Meanwhile column in this issue.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So dropping hints there. And he and Minch and Lin Wein clearly had high hopes for Black Mask. But it's kind of interesting because after this, the crisis basically stalled that for several years. He didn't even get a Who's Who entry because he missed the bees in Series 1 and no one bothered to include him in the updates, probably figuring he was a pre-crisis character no one cared about and had pretty much been wiped out. So if Mitch hadn't come back to the Batman books in the early 90s, I wonder if Black Mask would have ever been revived.
Maybe not. Well, I mean, you'd think somebody. I mean, it's a cool name. It's a cool look. So I would think somebody would have. But yeah, I think it was when Munch came back after Night Quest, after that whole saga. Is that because he had it was when Kelly Jones was drawing the book, too?
Yeah, he came on during Nightfall, I think.
Okay.
I think. I think he did. Yeah. So yeah, he was there for that, and then stuck around for several years later. Yeah, with the Kelly Jones and everything. Yeah, era. So yeah, and I was glad at this point to see that he was creating a new villain, because I was so sick and tired of his pet characters, Nocturna and her icky stepbrother, the Thief of Night, Night Thief, Night Slayer, showing up. He wouldn't stop using them. Maybe I'd think differently now, but as a 10-year-old, I was so over them. I was freezing. I mean, holy cow, here's Nocturna again. Oh my God, you know. And this is Tom Mandrake's first issue. I don't think I had really seen his work anywhere else before this. It was kind of similar to Gene Colan's in a lot of ways, very shadowy, kind of ethereal. And Colan was still drawing Detective around this period before and after this. So they kind of had a nice consistency between the Bat titles at this point. But
yeah, I always kind of found a similarity between them, partially because, like, when Gene Colan did the Spectre series around in the 80s, and then when Tom Mandrake did the Spectre series with John Ostrander in the 90s.
Right, right, that's right, yeah. And Doug Minch launched that Spectre series. So, yeah. So getting inside the comic, I like the splash. It's kind of Golden Age-like with this figure of Black Mask in the middle, and you see Batman's cowl, like several different versions of it coming at him, which fits, since this guy is supposed to enter the upper echelon of the rogues, you know. So I kind of like this. Kind of an unusual splash for this era. So what did you think of the whole the opening, the doctor dropping baby Roman? I mean, geez.
That's goddamn terrifying. Certainly. I read this issue before I was a parent, and it certainly hits differently now.
Yeah,
that's that fear. And, like, I mean, yeah, when Reese was a bit, he fell off of things, and I knew, like, that babies are a little bit more sturdy than you would think, but not entirely. And I mean, I always had fears, like, when I was carrying him when he was, like, just a few weeks old by a staircase, and I was just suddenly struck by this image of him falling down the stairs, and I almost, like, had to, like, sit down, and, like, it was like a fear like I'd never known before. And I've kind of developed a weird, like, acrophobia after that. And so it's just like, yeah, the way that, like, danger or injury to children, especially babies, like, it changes you now. So that's certainly a kind of freaky thing. But the fact that they use that kind of as a influence on maybe, like, something actually broke inside him when that happens, I don't know if I love that or hate it. The reason I might hate it is just in thinking that giving a sort of physical catalyst to what might be a psychological trauma or problem or something like that. Although that's fine. That's not necessary. But they also, just because of what we see later on with the raccoon bite and everything, might be a little bit over it, but it's definitely a haunting origin either way. Just this idea of, like, seeing, like, the baby, like, dropping the baby, and then just these eyes that, and just, like, from then on, just knowing that, like, from, like, you know, before his parents even held him, there was just something broken inside this kid that was just there. It's a really powerful setup for who this character could be.
Right. And I like, of course, the doctor, like all doctors are in any kind of surgery, he's wearing a mask.
Yeah.
And then the mom is more concerned about that the dad's bringing in the press to take a picture of the baby, and she hasn't had a chance to put her face on. And there's the Janus Cosmetics there, which, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, like, Doug's really going to kid you with masks, and, you know, so, but, you know.
I think it comes up 5 times every page, this idea of masks and public faces and things like that.
The theme song to Mask is, you know, my mask is coming. which came out in 1985, by the way. Roman is told to put on a smile for the Waynes, who he clearly hates, and tries to put on one when they visit their summer cabin. So their summer cabin, which has 14 rooms, they say. So that's a nice touch. Yeah. And then he doesn't even want to see a kid's cartoon. So, you know, he is really, Mitch is trying to say this kid was very unusual. He was not your typical happy-go-lucky kid from the get-go. And the nightmare image of the raccoon changing from the cartoon into a monster holding young Roman when he's in his delirium from the rabies bite is still emblazoned in my brain. It's this nightmare raccoon. It's like, holy cow. It's like, you know, if Rocket Raccoon was affected by gamma rays. I mean, it's disturbing.
It's a great image. But it's the one thing where I'm like, okay, what drove this kid crazy? What made him eventually a serial killer? Was it being dropped on his head as a baby, or was it like untreated rabies when he was like a 10-year-old or something like that? Like either one of those things could be the cause for him losing his mind. You don't need both of them.
Yeah. But
we get both of them. So
yeah, well, you know, it's, I feel like it's kind of like Rob and I recently talked about The Untold Legend of the Batman on Treasure Cast. Hopefully that, I think it's going to drop before this does. So, and we talked about, you know, all the different additives that were added to Batman's origin and that, and then the crisis wiped them away. And then they went ahead and added their own like post-crisis version, like, oh, in the Shaman story, they're wearing a bat mask to heal Bruce when he's in the, you know, Alaska or whatever. And then there's all these other like bat influences. So it's kind of like that. It's like, you just really need one catalyst. I'm with you, but it's right. Like I, Doug's really trying to, okay, this guy's messed up.
Yeah.
And we learned that the Sionises never sued the doctor for malpractice just because the mother didn't want to lose face. Just like, you know, they're not going to advertise the raccoon incident either. They didn't want to have anything, you know, have their family name drug through the mud. So,
right.
So, I mean, it really paints the parents in these, like, I mean, not that they deserve to be burned alive, but yeah, they're, you know, you're not really too tore up when,
yeah, exactly.
When they die, you know, I mean,
yeah.
I love the scene when he joins the company and his father says he'll have to work his way up like all the employees. Then the next panel has him looking out a high rise window with a caption that reads, "It took a month. The other employees were dazzled." And I have seen this happen at a company I worked for. There was lip service paid to the heir, doing it the hard way. They were put out like, oh, they're going to start in shipping, and then they're going to move into the office, and they're going to do this and do that. But there was never any doubt that they would end up being the president of the company, which they did. You know, it was like it was completely fast-tracked.
Yeah.
Even if they had been a total wreck at it, they were still going to get into that position. So,
yeah,
I've seen that happen. So.
Yeah. I guess Black Mask is a slightly more interesting name than Nepo Baby, but that could have been his villain name too, Nepo Baby.
Right. And of course, you know, there's the dichotomy with Bruce Wayne because they come from similar lineage, you know. Right. And this is the era before Batman, you know, it's like a lot of people like to portray Batman as, you know, almost as nuts as Black Mask here. So, so Roman meets Cersei and becomes infatuated. He becomes infatuated with her instantly, hires her on the spot, and even tells her he may be Janus Cosmetics sooner than even of us think. So he is clearly already planning on murdering his parents.
Mm-hmm. I was a little bit conflicted at first by how quickly he connected with Cersei. Cause I was like, a guy like this with what we know about him and his personality, he doesn't seem like the, you know, outgoing, affectionate dating type who would, you know, get in. But I guess, you know, he's got the connections, and not just the fact that she is a model, but as we see from her later on, she's very superficial. She's as obsessed with outward appearances as anybody else in this industry. So I think because of that, maybe he recognizes that he puts on a show for everything. Everything about him is a mask or disguise covering like whatever, you know, monster might be inside. So maybe the fact that she's so superficial, he knows that she's not going to see anything inside him because she couldn't look that closely.
Maybe. Yeah, I feel like it's just he's probably one of those guys that, you know, he probably never really had a girlfriend before. But now that he's like he's rich, he's privileged, and now he's in a top executive at this company. So he can, you know, he's filling his oats. He can do what he wants, you know. And that's kind of what I got from it. Because, yeah, I can't – he doesn't seem well-adjusted enough to really be working the dating scene, you know.
Right.
I feel like Tom Mandrake may be drawing Roman to look like a young Ray Milan, the actor, you know, from the Golden Age actor, who was, you know, pretty much a straight actor, although he was in a famous horror film, the Uninvited, the Ghost Story? I think that's called The Uninvited. I apologize, guys. I didn't write that down in my notes, and I'm blanking. Ghost movies titles get jumbled in my head. But he was in, later, he was in, you know, The Man with the X-Ray Eyes, and in the Premature Burial, the Roger Corman Poe adaptation, the one that doesn't have Vincent Price. He's a great actor, and he just seems like he's kind of got that rounded face. I feel like he's based on somebody.
So. Yeah, clearly he is. But there's also like when his parents tell him like he can't be with Cersei, like that third panel, his face is very kind of wide, very round, but like very small, slight details of his eyes and nose and mouth, and it just makes like. It really gives you an impression of kind of like a blank deadness about his face. Like, again, think that mask, that it's not, there's no anima, there's no soul in his expression.
Yeah, he does a great job of putting that across. Yeah. And I'm sorry, but his parents forbid him to date her. Didn't every big billionaire exec date a supermodel in the 80s? Even some that were married to other people? I mean... I like that his father has gotten heavier, which they point out as if gluttony affected his personal appearance. That's nice, yeah. And then Roman burns down his home with his parents inside, and I love the panel of those dead eyes looking through the bushes. Another mask. That's a nice touch. We do see that Commissioner Gordon, investigates their deaths, but Cersei is Roman's alibi. You know, he was with me all night, you know. And at their funeral, with closed caskets due to the burned corpses, all Roman can think of is getting into the lucrative mortician's makeup industry. It's like, wow, okay. Well, I mean, he killed him, so, you know, I can understand why he's not too choked up. He kicks out his PR department, takes their suite, and makes a lavish apartment for Cersei and a masked man cave for himself, as you do, you know. So... Well, we can't talk. We have toy collections, you know.
Exactly,
I'm not going to throw glass stones at a glass house. So, given it's the 80s in the MTV era, I think the face paint mask line could have worked as a subline, but not sinking every company resource into it and canceling, like, the traditional makeups. I mean, Roman is really a crappy executive. He really sucks at his job.
Yeah, my note was, gee, the psychopath's business idea flopped? Who'd have figured?
Yeah, go figure. And if this were Batman Family Reunion, we could point out this as the most dated 80s reference when one of the exec argues, Boy George and Cindy Lauper are cartoons. I saw Cindy Lauper in concert last year, but Cindy is a big fan. And she put on a great show. We went and saw her last year.
Oh, cool.
Yep, it was her final tour, so that was a great show. But yeah. So of course that flops hard, and then Roman doubles down on the untested water insoluble makeup, and we see a woman hiding her face, crying into her husband's arms. She says, "The rash on my face getting worse, and the skin on my face peeling off." Like, that's like, ooh. And the husband's like, it's that makeup you bought. It has to be, you know. And I like that they don't show it, though, because it just, like, it makes you wonder, like, because she's got her head in his chest and he's holding her. And it just makes you wonder, God, how bad does this look, you know? It's like, ugh.
Right.
It's weird because it kind of reminds me, I couldn't help reading this. I'm like, did Sam Hamm read this arc when he was doing the Smilex thing with the The Joker.
I thought of that too.
Yeah. So was this stack of comics around when that was being written? I don't know. But in Batman 89. But Cersei abandons the sinking ship and dumps him in front of everyone. Then the Wayne Foundation, not yet Wayne Enterprises, you can note, swoops in to bail them out just because Thomas and Richard had been friends, which I don't really think Richard was friends with anybody, but maybe Thomas thought they were. And we do briefly see Lucius Fox. So again, all of Batman's supporting cast is showing up before he does in his comic. So, yeah. So do you think Roman was just going to go to the crypt and mutilate his father's corpse to make himself feel better?
Yeah, possibly, probably. Yeah. Like, I don't know what he had in mind, but it's, yeah,
because he said he goes there because he can't, like, blame himself. He can't despise himself, so he's incapable of, like, basically taking any blame for what his life's turned into. So what do you think about the lightning strike of fate?
I don't love it. It just seems like a weird little supernatural Deus Ex Machina touch for inspiration that's really not necessary in this case. Like, I don't know how much it accomplishes. Like, is that another sort of thing that's supposed to, you know, be intervening and making him a little bit crazy? I don't think that was necessary. I don't know that that added anything.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, I know he says, you know, I fell again and I'm reborn. You know, it's like the man who falls, which you and I covered on the last Secret Origins episode. With Batman. But I can't decide about that either. Tom Mandrake draws the hell out of it. I love the...
The page is...
Of course, the art in this is really, really sharp. I mean, it's perfect for this story because it's so shadowy and dark.
Actually, with the yellow lightning bolts with the red outline, maybe that lightning bolt was Barry Allen.
Maybe. And this is 1985. The skies look red. Crisis. This is Barry Allen going back through time to warn.
That's on his way to create himself.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
he happens to zip through this mausoleum on this.
Well, he does stop in Gotham City and see Batman. We know that, right? Because he sees when Batman's fighting the Joker in Crisis and in Let's see. His father's corpse is pretty disturbing looking, and nice to be close up. And the image of him giggling is disturbing, and he looks like the Riddler from the Batman, from the Matt Reeves Batman. He looks like Dano. He looks like
I see that.
The hair and the round face and the beady eyes. He looks like him right there.
yeah, he does.
Yeah, so. You know, Gordon and Bullock investigate Roman's disappearance, and we get panels of him carving his mask, like, off to the side, which I think is a nice touch. You know, there's their investigation, and over to the side, there's this column of panels where he's carving the mask out of his father's coffin lid.
Which is great. That's such a cool touch.
Yeah, that is. I mean, it's kind of, you know, I don't know, it's like, the Lone Ranger's mask was made from his brother's vest.
Right.
So I always thought that was cool. I mean, which he had been shot through. So I always thought that was a cool, you know, bit that the Lone Ranger did that. So this is like an evil version of that, you know. So I do have a question, though. When he invites the people to join his society and they're in the crypt and he's put all of his masks up, where do you get that giant black mask over the coffins from?
I don't know. Like, for a minute there, I wasn't sure if that was like a decoration, like another mask, or if that was just symbolic of him or something. Like, I wasn't sure. And why is he hiding in the coffin?
I think he's just a creepy dude who likes to lay in his father's coffin. I think that's
true. I didn't need to ask that question. I didn't need an answer for that. But
yeah, it's like, in naming the gang the False Face Society, do you think Minch was calling back to the obscure Batman villain who also appeared in two episodes of the 66 TV series? Or is it just a good name?
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too, because False Face was creepy on Batman 66. I mean, those semi-transparent plastic masks with the weird makeup on top of them, with the cheeks and the blue around the eyes, and those masks are creepy anyway. And Malachi Thorne, that played him, did a hell of a job. And in that episode, I wish he came back. He's a good villain. But As we mentioned, Batman finally appears in his own comic on page 21. So, yay! That's what you paid your 75 cents for, kids, you know, including me. And the false facer he apprehends has a face that looks like the Joker. He's dressed like a jester, and he's got an elongated clown harlequin face, you know, which I think is kind of interesting. So, you know, I'm surprised Joker isn't, you know, going to come after Black Mask for infringing on his appearance. We then see Black Mask is spying on Cersei, who is undressing and just in her underwear. So you don't see anything, really, but she is topless.
Because of the 80s.
It's the 80s, yep. Then the ghastly Phantom of the Opera-like face beneath the pig mask of the executive that they killed, which is, you know, and very well drawn by Mandrake, of course. We're off to a great start and a very grisly story for a mainstream superhero comics in 1985, I think.
And yeah, the gimmick of using this makeup adhesive thing to basically glue down a mask to somebody's face so that when they take it off, it just peels or burns the skin off is horrifying and just creepy and really cool for a villain.
Mm-hmm.
My only thing is, I think he's got a great setup for being this bad guy and being this psychopath, but everything about his origin that we've seen up to in the beginning strikes me as so much more of a loner, that him kind of becoming a gang leader, I'm not sure I believe that as much. I definitely think, I mean, he wanted to run the company. I think he wanted power. I'm kind of talking myself into this because he wanted the public, he wanted to have the face of authority. He wanted people to see, he didn't want to lose face. You know, he wanted this kind of perception that he was the boss, that he was in charge. So I can kind of see him becoming the leader of this group. But it's a big jump. It's a pretty quick jump. So, but yeah, I don't know. I like the story too much to care that much about it.
Yeah,
there are a few flaws in the story, but they don't detract from my enjoyment of it in any way.
Yeah, same here. Yeah, it's solid. It's a good start. And I do wonder though, Janus Cosmetics, how did Two-Face not target them?
Right.
Over the years.
Right, Janus the two-faced god.
Right.
Roman god.
Right.
And it's a Roman god like Roman Cialis.
Yeah,
and,
nice.
Yeah, notably it was a god that was in a distinctly Roman god. There was no Greek counterpart to it.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. Oh, nice to know, yeah. Yeah, but I think we're off to a good start. And I remember, you know, again, I remember reading this going, okay, this guy seems pretty cool. I'm in. You know, this is a good it hooked me. I was buying Batman anyway. I was going to buy the next issue is in Detective, next part's in Detective, but I was going to buy it anyway. But it was like I was on board. So yeah, I still feel the same way. It still holds up. It's still pretty creepy. Still pretty. It's again, it's a touch darker than what had gone before, and it does feel like it's got a little bit of that night. A little bit of 1986 is starting to creep into our 1985. You know.
I love that some people will know exactly what you mean when you say that. What an odd hobby we have.
Yes.
Alrighty, folks, we are going to take a short promo break, but when we come back, Batman and Robin, Year One, Issue 7. Stick around.
According to the latest report from falsifiedstats.com, 2.3 million new comic book podcasts are being created every single day. If you're looking for something a little different, then let me tell you about Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow. Mike travels the globe and visits comic shops along the way, like Murfreesboro, Illinois, and Liverpool, New South Wales, Australia. So check out Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow, a truly unique comic book podcast among billions of the same old, same old.
Grab your bat microphone, it's time to start the show.
Welcome to the Bat Pod, a Batman comic book discussion podcast.
Whoa, what are you doing? That's my line.
I'm starting the show. I was waiting on you. We're starting the show.
I'm the one that says that. You're my new co-host, where we talk about back issues of Batman, could be in Detective Comics, World Finest.
Could we do some Shadow of the Bat and maybe some Nightwing, maybe some Batgirl?
Absolutely.
Can we also define where my co-hosting parameters start and end? I can't start the show, but I can definitely co-host it.
Well, maybe we'll let you start the show.
Okay, at least I get to pick one of the books we're covering on each episode, and you can pick the other?
Absolutely.
Can I close out the show? Can I bring friends? Will there be snacks?
What is your favorite bet snack?
Cucumber sandwiches.
Join Bill Beer and J. David Weider every 2 weeks on the Bet Pod. You can find us on your favorite podcast app.
Grab your headphones, listen up. You know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight Detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
Batman and Robin Year 1, Number 7 came out on May 21st, 2025. A year from tomorrow, as of when we're recording this. Mm-hmm. The cover shows a close-up of the folder containing photos of Gothamites, the police suspected of being Batman's secret identity. What do you think of this cover?
This cover is a little deceptive because at first it seems a bit dull, but then it it's very muted colors, lots of blank space up top. But this shows the brilliance of Chris Samnee, because if you look closer, the file folders and other pieces of paper that are casting a shadow over Bruce Wayne's upper face, they're also creating the ears of Batman's cowl. So you can see Batman's cowl over Bruce's face.
Yeah.
And then you step back, and the lower part of that makes the different photos spread out, makes the bat symbol as Samnee draws it.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
it's such a design that, I had the same, the first time I saw it, I was like, kind of a boring cover. I get it. Okay, interesting. Like, it tells what this was about. But then one of those things where you look at it, it's like, oh my God, it's the bat symbol. Yeah. Like, what?
Yeah, and it's got the double Easter egg of the Bruce Batman, his face being shadowed like the cowl.
Yes, the little shadow over the cowl. It's like, yeah.
So it's perfect. It's I mean, God, that guy's good. He's so good.
All right. Chapter 7 is co-plotted by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee, with Waid scripting and Samnee drawing. Matthias Lopez colored the issue, Clayton Cowles lettered it, and Andrew Marino and Rob Levin edited it. General Grimaldi chews Clayface out for failing to kill Batman and allowing the Dark Knight to discover Martin Kosky's body before Grimaldi could siphon all of his money. Clayface demonstrates his ability to impersonate the general himself, and Grimaldi orders him out. He verbally abuses his invalid father some more, then turns his attention to the files listing men the police suspect of being Batman. Batman and Robin have a busy week keeping the city safe as fallout from Grimaldi's scheme has the various mob factions at war with each other. Batman saves mob boss Franco Bertinelli and tells him that Grimaldi is playing the bosses off each other. He saves Franco from a bomb in exchange for Franco arranging a truce with the other families. At school, Dick shows off his acrobatic talents in front of the other kids, drawing the ire of a schoolyard bully. Laura Lynn from Child Services pays Dick a surprise visit at the school. She notices bruises on his arm. Dick inconspicuously provokes the bully into punching him so he can blame the bruises on playground fighting. Bruce tells Dick he's proud of the clever way he defused the situation. He also tells Dick that someone is following him, probably Grimaldi's men. Elsewhere, Two-Face tracks Clayface down, having learned his identity and the nature of his powers. He warns Clayface that Grimaldi will never cure his affliction and proposes a different sort of partnership between them. In houses all over Gotham, Grimaldi's men murder the people from the files suspected of being Batman, and the next name on the list is Bruce Wayne. All right, what'd you think about this one?
So two comics this month, at the end, both the targets are Bruce Wayne in the next issue. No, this is a great issue. It's a bit of a breather issue that gives us a chance to check in with the characters, and which I like that. Especially when you've got a 12-part series, you can do that.
Right.
That's a part of decompressed storytelling I don't mind. I like that. So I feel like there are some good character moments. It does advance each story, and it does give a little more motivation for each character. It's another great issue. So
right from the beginning, and I think we kind of mentioned this before, but Clayface, the Matt Hagen version, wearing this outfit with this mask, this sturdy, like theatrical. I mean, it's something. It's reminding me of what we were just talking about—a little bit of Black Mask, but also a little bit of False Face from the Batman show. Mm-hmm. But also, like in this particular look with the suit and a sort of cravat-like tie and a fedora, there's a little bit of Basil Carlo in his look in this one.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I definitely feel like that's what they were. That's what he was kind of going for, to kind of harken back to that a little bit. Yeah,
it's nice when he kind of taunts Grimaldi by turning his face into Grimaldi's face. Put a pin in that, folks, because that might come back in a couple issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I like the fact, too, that he's like, why did you keep Kosky's body around? He's like, hey, I need to have reference, you know?
Yeah.
It's not easy to do this, right? You know, which, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, if you know, you'd have to, like, if that's how you do, you know, you have to look at somebody to duplicate them. You'd have to have them around to, you know, which is why he didn't we were kind of questioning, why did he leave the body in there like that? Well, that's why. Mark Waid answered our question from last time, so.
Right. And I like his, Grimaldi gets so pissed off that he's impersonating him, he kicks him out of there, he shouts at him, and just as Hagen is walking out, you can just see him, like, the corners of his mouth, he's, like, smiling at him.
Yeah, and it looks like the mask underneath, his face underneath that mask looks like the mask with the little pencil-thin mustache. And
yeah.
So I guess that's Matt Hagen's face. Is he in this, like, you know, this version, that's what he looks like, so.
Yeah, or whatever, yeah.
Or it's the one he's adopted as his face anyway, so.
And then we get the montage of two pages with different panels for every day of, you know, Batman and Robin going through their weekly business. And I couldn't help it. When I was looking at these pages, I was singing in my head, Sunday, Monday, happy days, Tuesday, Wednesday.
I love it. It'd be funny if they had him, like, you know, fighting Arthur Fonzarelli or something, breaking up a gang or something. But, you know, I do like that we do get on one of those days. We get a pretty obscure villain appearance there. It's just like another Chris Samnee Easter egg there.
The Terrible Trio?
Yes. Yes.
That was nice. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Vulture, the Shark, and the Fox, I mean, you know, they don't get a lot of play, although they did appear on an episode of Batman the Animated Series, but a lot of people forget that. But
true.
Yeah, they're pretty obscure. But I've always thought they had a cool visual, so I always kind of like it when they show up.
And Robin just, holy overtime, Batman, and him just, don't.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me back when we were doing the Barr Davis run, when Robin, like, there's something about a printing press, and they were in some clue about a printing press, and they're in Gordon's office, and Robin's like, holy Gutenberg! And Batman just grabs Jason Todd and says, don't ever do that again. And there's this question mark over Jason's head, like, why is he so upset? You know? So,
We also get this scene as they're kind of just driving in the Batmobile through Gotham. Jason's feeling tired. He's exhausted from the work. He's got his feet up, and Batman just feet off the dash.
Yeah.
And he's like, aren't you hungry? He's like, do you want to eat? He's like, what, you mean like pull into a drive-through or something, like in the Batmobile? And Robin's kind of like, he's like, have you ever had fast food? I can't see it.
Yeah. I love that bit. It makes me think of the, you know, the bit in Batman Forever, you know, I'll get drive-through. You know, it's just... But yeah, I can't. Yeah, I bet you Bruce Wayne. I can't imagine that he has probably ever had fast food. I doubt it. You know, I think of the Lego Batman movie when he comes home and microwaves his lobster thermidor. Yeah. You know, he's in his smoking jacket with his bat cowl on, microwaving lobster. You know,
yeah. The page when they're outside Bertinelli's restaurant. I love these two panels where they're on the roof overlooking, and he's got the panels are split, but it's like, it's one shot of Batman standing there talking, but he's got Robin doing something different in both panels. And one, he's kind of behind him looking off, and the other one, he's crouched down in front of him looking down the street. And you just kind of get the impression that Robin is always in motion. Batman can stand still and just cast that shadow, but Robin is always doing something because Dick can't help but move around.
Yeah, I love it. I love it when that's a great bit. I'm glad you. I hadn't really caught it this time, but I love when artists do that, and it makes me think. I'm always referencing different Bat media. I'm sorry, but there's the great bit in the Holiday Nights episode of the new Batman Adventures version of a Batman animated series, where Batman and Tim, as little Tim Robin, they leap onto a rooftop, and Batman lands, and Tim doesn't quite make it, and he like. Hits the roof and then scrambles up. You know, it's like hits the ledge and scrambles up. It makes me think of that they're always he's always hopping around. Like you said, he's full of you know nervous energy. You know, just because he's a kid and he's a circus acrobat and you know he's like this little he's the laughing young daredevil. So he's hopping around a lot.
There's a bit of a typo on one of these pages because Batman mentions that Franco Bertinelli is eating at this restaurant and he says that some of Sal Maroni's men have placed a bomb in there. Or he's like, this guy specializes in munitions. He's like, stay here, Robin. And wait, he's like, munitions? You mean like a bomb? Yeah. But then when Batman crashes through, he says, you know, Bertinelli's men are planning to kill you. It's like, no, he's Bertinelli. He means Maroni's men. So they got that name wrong in the script or the lettering.
Yeah, and of course, Bertinelli, that's the Huntress's family.
Right, right.
And Maroni's the guy that scars Two-Face. Right. So, yeah.
All these people in the world, yeah. They've all got connections.
Right. Well, this makes sense because there's a gang war going on.
Right, thanks
to Grimaldi. So, I mean, and I like the fact that we get the Bertinellis in here because that helps establish, you know, the Huntress presence in Gotham. So.
Who she'll be eventually, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, he's basically playing chicken with Bertinelli as this guy, Franco's like, demanding. He's like, turn off the bomb, stop the bomb, stop the bomb. He's like, you're going to call the others and you're going to call a truce. And he's like, yes, I'll do it. And you just see something happens and he just kind of walks out there and there's a fork stuck in the bomb with 1 second left.
Yeah, Batman literally stuck a fork in it. Yeah, so I like that. Yeah. Sticks a fork in it and walks out.
Yeah, he kind of walks by Robin and he's like, saving mobsters isn't my favorite thing to do. But lives are lives.
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah, yeah.
And that's followed by a hell of a splash page.
Oh, yeah, that's a beautiful. That's like poster worthy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder what the round thing in the back of Batman's utility belt is. Is that the spool that the grapple line goes to? Or, you know, because Robin's got his Robin fanny pack, which we see on the next page.
Good question.
Either that or that's his Golden Age belt buckle and he can just, like, you know, move the belt around. Like, you know, it can either be the square one or the round one, depending on what mood he's in that day, you know. So.
Since this is an audio medium, folks, we're gushing over a splash page of Batman and Robin leaping over the city, and they're kind of impossibly high. Batman has his back to us with his cape fanning out, and Robin is, like, upside down, all around, carefree, smiling. But, yeah, this is one of those images where, like, if you saw the original pencil sketches of this, you'd, you know, spend $1,000,000,000 to get it.
Yeah, for sure.
And they get back to the cave, and Alfred he's got his tie undone. He's been working hard.
I like the fact that Dick is listening to Alfred and Bruce talk about him. You can tell because Alfred's like, how goes it with the boy? And he's like, better. He's becoming more responsible. I'll take my victories in millimeters if I must, you know. So, but Dick's clearly listening. He's acting. He's taking his boot off, asking like he's not, but he clearly is. You know, it's like, you know, and he's listening to him.
So. I also like that he took his cape off and just put it on a rock in the cave. Like, I get the impression he's just like stripping down, and these clothes are just going to be on the floor waiting for Alfred to pick them up.
Yeah, they don't go in a vault or, you know, back into the bat pole thing, however that works, you know, they just throw them around. But I like that, you know, Bruce says he's becoming more responsible, and then we go to the next scene, which, you know, kind of blows that.
he's on the playground doing a one-handed handstand on a piece of playground equipment, overlooking everybody, and just like, da-da-da-da. And these two girls on the playground, like, I'm in love. And they're like, he can do all that and he's rich. And he's like, wait, I am rich.
Yeah. It's like it just occurred to him. It's like, oh, wait. Yeah. Yeah.
What did you think of this bully?
You know, this whole scene is, you know, it's you know, I think it's necessary to show that, you know, how what Dick has to deal with. And they. they've done that in the past. There's even a bit of that in The Untold Legend of the Batman that, you know, Dick has to, he can't show that he knows how to fight, or a lot of times they wouldn't even have him show that he was an acrobat like that. But, you know, but I think that's fine. The only thing I don't like is that, you know, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but, you know, Dick, like you said in the synopsis, he basically, when Laura Lynn is on to him about he's got bruises on his arm, he throws a note to the bully who already punched him once and says, "You punch like a girl." And so the bully decks him in front of Laura and one of the teachers, and they let this kid walk away.
Yeah.
I mean, the kid should be expelled, you right. know? Or at least suspended.
That was my bigger thing when we saw, like, yeah, looking at him and his attitude, I'm like, I don't know how this kid is in the same school as Dick Grayson.
Right, right. I mean, this kid likes, yeah, he's like this, you know, he's this heavyset kid with a Freddy Krueger type, you know, sweater on, and he like punches Dick once bumps him, punches, and then he really cocks him, you know, sock. And yeah. and they just let it happen. They blacks his eye.
Yeah,
I mean, sure. yeah, like what kind of, and the lady's like, "I can assure you nothing like that happens at our school." And then it happens, right? Which I know that's the part of the funny, that, but she's like, right. "See, we have zero tolerance," and then they let it happen, which I mean, I know it's part of the gag, but Sammy draws him walking away like he's far away from them. They're not trying to chase him, which I'm like, nail that kid to the wall, you know?
Yeah, it's real. To say nothing of your responsibility as adults and educators to prevent this type of violence or stop it. It's like, do you really want Bruce Wayne's lawyers coming after you about this?
True. Yeah, very good point. Yeah, yeah.
All that aside, I like this scene because, again, we get this surprise visit from Laura Lynn. She's very easy to forget about because she's not a villain, per se. She's not somebody that we know really well, but she poses this unique threat. She'll show up at random when you least suspect it, and they have to adapt to it. They have to respond. So when she sees bruises on Dick's arm, and she's like, "How did that happen?" And he's like, "I gotta get myself beat up in front of her in order to cover for this."
Yeah, yeah. And I love the fact later, it's like, Bruce is proud of him. "I'm proud of you for what it's worth. I'm proud of you for getting hit in the eye, you know?"
Yeah. Alfred says, he's like, "Dinner is served. Alas, we're now out of peas," because he's holding a bag of frozen peas to his eye.
And Dick's like, comedy with the little dripping right. frozen, yeah, word balloon, which is a nice touch, yeah. Yeah.
And that's when Bruce kind of mentions that he's being, somebody is following him and he suspects that it's Grimaldi's men, although kind of doesn't understand why. He kind of misattributes it to something related to Martin Kosky and wanting the money that he didn't get there. But we know it's a different reason. And from there we see there's one of his goons outside Wayne Manor listening to the window.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. And he's very well hidden in the grass. Although, again, this kind of brings up what we in the Christmas issue, why are there all sorts of alarms, like motion detectors, alarms on Wayne Manor's grounds to, like, say this? I know Bruce said he's letting this guy follow him, but I don't know if he'd want to let him follow him that close to the house, you know?
Right.
Especially with the Bat Cave being underneath it.
Then we get the scene between Two-Face and Clayface, and Clayface is looking in the mirror, impersonating Two-Face, his clay face into Two-Face. And that's when Two-Face shows up and he's like, "Yeah, I was a handsome devil," when he shows him like what he looked like unscarred. And Clayface gets very territorial. He's like, "How did you get in here?" And he's like ready to get violent and throw him out. But they don't answer the question, why was he practicing being Two-Face? I kind of get the feeling that Grimaldi was expecting him or about to order him to take Two-Face out.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, because I can't imagine, or either that or he was just, you know, practicing somebody that would be hard to do that literally had a two-sided face. I don't know, but yeah. But yeah, that's probably the better reason.
We established, because Two-Face kind of has a background now, this version of Clayface is Matt Hagen. It's the composite origin, because now we have the name Matt Hagen, but he was an actor. So he kind of has like the Basil Carlo background, but also he's the full clay monster shape changer thing of Matt Hagen. So
right.
They've really kind of blended the two of those, the first two Clayface figures into one.
Yeah, it's basically the animated series take. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Which I believe is what the movie is going to be,
yes.
too.
Yes.
And yeah, he's basically saying, like, I know Grimaldi promised you he can cure your condition. He can't. He has no interest in doing it, even if he could. He's like, but, you know, maybe we can come up to another arrangement.
Yeah.
And then we see goons with shotguns sneaking through a fancy-looking house in the dark. We have no reason to think this isn't Wayne Manor, because we get a guy, we hear a guy talking to what sounds like his son in the next room, and the goons run in with their shotguns, and we just cut to outside a house, and blam, blam, and then dark. And then we see, oh, it's a different house, it's a different father and son, not Bruce Wayne, but they're still dead.
Yeah, and it's pretty gruesome if you think about it, because that's a young kid with his head down in a pool of blood at the dinner table, at the dining or the kitchen table.
Yeah.
Somebody named Jim Krause and his son, I guess, just got killed. And I mean, that's pretty dark and kind of, it's upsetting, you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, it's upsetting. So it's like, yeah, these people have no, I mean, Grimaldi didn't kill Robin when he had him before, but you know, he said he wouldn't, you know, he's now, you know, I think he said something, he wouldn't, you know, hurt a kid or something, basically. But clearly that's changed now, because mm-hmm. Batman has become too much of a thorn in his side, because he's killing kids that may be Robin, that he doesn't even sure are Robin. So I remember when I got this issue and got to the end, you know, plus, like you said, you feel like it's probably Bruce and Dick. And then, of course, you realize when they're laying there dead, it's not. But it's still... it's still pretty harrowing.
And this Jim Krause guy, sadly, the last words to his son, they're talking about going fishing for the weekend. And maybe this was on my mind because I've just recently been rewatching the 66 show. But wasn't that the excuse they always gave Aunt Harriet? Like when Bruce and Dick had to excuse themselves, they're going fishing or something?
Yeah, usually fishing or bird watching of some kind, you know, like... like so-and-so said they saw a rare albatross at the Glen, you know, it's like, holy, you know, blah, 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 Bruce, yes, let's go, you know, and they'd run off and, well, where are they off to now, Alfred? You know, that type of stuff. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A gruesome ending to the chapter and a nice cliffhanger, because now we know, again, Bruce Wayne himself being targeted, not Batman, but Bruce Wayne because they think he's Batman. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, another great issue, another fun time.
Yep. And so next episode, come back for two stories where Bruce Wayne is the target of the villain, which we did not do on purpose. It just happened that way, right?
We didn't. No, yeah. Just, yeah. Just like I didn't intend for Clayface to be a major villain in the story as we were leading up to the release of the movie too. But yeah, so yeah. It goes.
There you go.
But yeah, Chris was absolutely right. Next month, we're going to cover issue 8 of Batman and Robin Year One and the next issue of Detective Comics that followed that issue. So the second chapter of the Black Mask story. Looking forward to that. Anything else before we go?
Nope. I think we've covered it pretty well, and I'm looking forward to both of those because I am very invested. It's not like I haven't read them before, but I'm ready to reread them and talk about them with you because that's always a great time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Had a blast. All right, folks. Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening. Under the blue moon, I saw you. So soon, you'll take me up in your arms, too late to beg you. Or cancel it, though I know it must be the killing time. Unwillingly mine. Fate up against your will. Give yourself to